Good morning. My name is Travis. I'm one of the pastors here at Reality Church, and today we are on our fourth week of our series, Under the Rug. During this series, we've been looking at sins that we pretty much all have in our lives, but we don't ever acknowledge or notice. They often get swept under the rug. And today, what we are looking at is the sin of consumerism. Right. Somebody goes like, great, one of these sermons. This is why I came to church today. You kidding me? No, but this is been a really tough one for me just like working on and writing this because this is a subject that has been so revealing in my own life here. I mean, we know that we live in a consumer society. We know that we have to consume resources to survive, that God designed us that way. And we have to face the reality that we all are dependent consumers. You know, there's a reason why a lot of times when our fridge breaks down, it's often cheaper to buy a new one than get it fixed, or that's why you don't see too many flat-screen TV repair shops out there these days. Very few of us live on farms, okay? Some of you guys might have chickens in your backyard, those people. But most of us have to go to the grocery store to purchase eggs or food, whatever we need. I know some people that make their own clothes. They're cool people. I like them. But still, we have to go out and purchase those as well. There was a TED Talk a few years ago about a guy who decided to build his own toaster out of scratch. So his plan was he went out and bought the cheapest toaster he could find. He disassembled it and it had about 400 parts inside of it there. And his plan was to reverse engineer those. You can see videos. He actually went out and mined his own iron and copper and mica. It took him 9 months, about 250 times the cost of the original toaster. And when he got done, he had this thing. He said it worked, but, you know, not exactly a practical way to live. And so I got to start this by saying I'm not going to suggest this sermon that we all stop spending money or that Christmas we boycott the commercialism of the holiday. You know, I mean, we two-thirds of the U.S. economy is based on consumer spending. And if we all decided to stop, it would likely destroy our economy. In fact, I know some of you guys probably participated in Prime Day that was just a couple days ago. And for me, I think it's really a tragedy that it's just become this mindless holiday of consumer spending, and nobody remembers the birth of Optimus Prime. Glad some of you guys got that. All right. But honestly, though, beyond consumerism, though, this beyond a behavior, it's given us all a set of these presuppositions that most of us have been formed to carry with us without even question. So this morning, as we move through this elephant under the rug, we're going to take it in three swift bites. First, we're going to look at how consumerism has shaped our lives and our minds in ways that we probably don't even notice. Secondly, we're going to look at how this has in fact distorted our faith and how we view and relate to God. And third, homework. Yes, summertime homework, guys. No, but I'm serious about this, though. I'm going to give you guys some real, tangible, practical steps that I truly believe if you take this seriously. It's not going to only change your life and your family's life, but it's going to change the way you relate to God and the work that you do building his kingdom here, the work that you were made to do. Because right now in my life, I've moved into this weird kind of quasi-middle-aged group. I'm going to be like 34 here in a couple weeks, got a few gray hairs, I got two kids, got another one on the way, and it seems all of a sudden I have noticed that so much of advertising and marketing is targeted at me. Great. You know, I have this mythical thing called disposable income. So you guys might have heard of this unicorn out there. I don't know what to do with it, so I turned to advertising to help me make decisions on what to do with it all. But, I mean, you guys I'm talking about, you know? Yes. Yes, I want to lose weight. Of course I do. What do I need? Yes, I want the energy and vigorosity I had as a 21-year-old man. Yes, I want the softest toilet paper that money can buy. Yes, you put a Star Wars label on anything, I will buy it gladly. Yes, I want my charming and beautiful family to be safe as we venture across the Southwest in our beautiful Honda Pilot singing Weezer's Buddy Holly. You guys have seen this commercial. Some of you guys know Weezer. That was like the first CD I bought when I was in seventh grade, and I saw this commercial. I'm like, I want to be that cool, hip-looking dad. Man, that guy's got it going on. Look at that family. For some foolish reason, we decided to let our daughter start playing with Legos at about a year and a half, and that kind of progressed into a Lego video game, and she's our first child, so, you know, we're learning here. But we're playing this game, you guys might have heard of this, it's called Lego Dimensions. There's other games like it, one called Skylanders, there's an Amiibo one for Nintendo, where you buy this game, And then you buy all these extra toys that you put into the game. The game kind of teases it out to you. It's like, sorry, you haven't bought the Doctor Who expansion pack. Go to the store and spend $30 on this, and you can unlock these levels. It's ridiculous. And I totally fell for this hook, line, and sinker. And like, I'm playing this game, and I'm asking myself, who in the world are they targeting here? Are they targeting 8-year-olds, the game says they're the age group it's for, or are they targeting 34-year-old men? Because seriously, like, I was looking at the characters in this game so far. We have some Back to the Future. So my daughter knows who Marty McFly is now. We have Lord of the Rings, Ghostbusters, Portal, Simpsons, Doctor Who. I mean, all things that I like. And recently, they unveiled some new characters that are targeted a bit more at children these days. Characters such as Sloth from the Goonies, E.T., the Gremlins. From A-Team, you got Mr. T there. Because what 8-year-old doesn't want a Mr. T Lego minifig? Right? But, I mean, honestly, Lego was my childhood jam, you know? That was, like, my thing. And even as an adult, it still has this weird hold on me. Because these brands and these companies that I've come to trust in my life, they've been working on me subconsciously. These brands that I identify with, and we all do this. We all have companies that we identify with, whether it be Callaway, Nike, Nintendo, or Levi's. We find these brands, like, yeah, that's kind of me. That's where my identity is that. Apple did this brilliantly a couple years ago. If you guys remember the commercials where I had like the really cool guy, hey guys, I'm a Mac, and then the real square guy, and I'm a PC. And it told us, yeah, you know what, I don't want to be some square with a PC, I want to be this hip cool dude living with his bros, like the Mac guy. And today I own like 3 Mac devices, so again, I'm a sucker for this stuff. Colin Bates, he's a marketing expert, says that a brand is a collection of perceptions in the mind of a consumer. And as such, the goal of branding isn't to develop an eye-catching logo. The goal of branding is to manipulate people's minds so they involuntarily associate a logo with a predetermined set of feelings. We know there's nothing inherently luxurious about a 3-pointed star within a circle. But when you see that, we instantly think of luxury, of status, of wealth, of someone who has made it. If you guys saw my signature, you wouldn't get many feelings out of it. But for some reason, the scripted signature of Walt Disney instantly brings up these warm feelings of, oh, this is going to be a great movie. It's going to have a great song. They're going to parody a church maybe. But, you know, feelings like our childhood. It gives you these good, warm feelings. A Stanford University study found that carrots, milk, and apple juice actually tasted better to kids when they were packaged in a McDonald's wrapper. Dr. Tom Robbins, who headed the study, said that children's tastes were physically altered by the branding, that the children's emotional ties to the brand affected their perception and their reality. By creating this connection, like the Colin Bates actually went on to say that a brand is the most valuable real estate in the world, a corner of the consumer's minds. So many of these companies are holding pieces of my mind and all of our minds. And again, this is kind of part of the culture that we live in today. I know some of you thinking like, wait a minute, man, I thought this is a church sermon, not some kind of speech about the perils of advertising and companies. But just track with me here, because I know some of you thinking this is going to probably come down to materialism. You know, a tendency to think that stuff and comfort is the most important factors in our lives. And while it's true that materialism is an idol of our culture, it's not the core problem. The core problem is the worldview of consumerism. A worldview is the way that we see the world and our place within it. See, more than an economic system, consumerism is the dominant worldview of North Americans. It's this dominant worldview that tells us that life consists of the manufacturing and satisfying of desires. Often ads are these profits of advertising, telling us about things that we didn't even know that we needed or wanted, desires that I never knew I had until I saw this ad that kind of told me, this is what I need to find fulfillment. Every day, it says New York Times says we're exposed to 3,500 desire-inducing ads that tell you that satisfaction and fulfillment is just one more purchase away. But like so many of these elements of our culture, this diffusion of desire, Emily Fogg Mead was a this is in 1901, she wrote some of this stuff here about how that this diffusion of desire through culture is what that they're going for. And it's not so much that they're worried, concerned with the ability for consumers to pay, but with the ability to want. I know some of you are thinking like, okay, not so much me, you know, I wear a belt made out of rope and eat rice all the time. This isn't really my problem. But the thing is, there's so many elements of consumer culture It's not the commodification, but it's rather the pervasiveness of it, how it seeps into every single part of our lives. In a commodity culture, we've been conditioned to believe that nothing carries intrinsic value. That a thing's value or a person's value or worth is only found in its usefulness to us, and unfortunately, this has been applied to people as well. We know that divorce has skyrocketed. That spouses, when we become bored or frustrated with them, can easily be replaced. There's plenty of others to choose from out there. One we might even like better than one we've got now. The fact that abortion is morally justifiable because an unborn child is not considered to be a person. See, personhood is reserved for those who have usefulness. Prostitution and sex trafficking is so prevalent because we have commodified sexuality. Pornography is an epidemic not just in the United States, but in the church, because we believe that that person on the screen has no value aside from satisfying my desires. In human trafficking, you know, we today look back at history. We see the horrors of the African slave trade, where humans were packed into ships like cargo, or the Holocaust, where people deemed unuseful were executed. And we look back at this and we think that this was a horrible time, but the fact remains that there are more slaves in the world today than at any point in history. The UN estimates that there's somewhere between 30 to 40 million people in slavery today. 26% of those are children. That's because people, the image bearers of God, have become a disposable commodity. And herein lies this crux to this sin that we've unknowingly swept under the rug. Yes, there's a lot to dive into when it comes to materialism and consumption. And if you ever doubt that there is a spiritual war going on around you right now, that there is a force in this world that hates humanity and wants to see us damaged and destroyed, just look at the debris you see in the lives of people around you, the damage that's been on the souls of your family, the damage you have felt in your own life, because not a single one of us has not avoided being inflicted by this. See, consumerism, it's the framework through which we understand everything, and this includes the church and the gospel and God himself. Because this is what it comes down to, that when you are cultivated and shaped and nurtured in a consumer economy, you have to understand that this is going to impact your view of God as well. You didn't realize it. This is nothing you've done intentionally, but this consumer culture has shaped the way we relate to our Heavenly Father. The consumer world, it says that he has no value apart from what he can do for us. He's a tool that we employ, a force that we control, or a resource that we plunder. We ascribe value to him. Like we talk about worshiping God. When we're worshiping God, we're telling God how good he is, how great he is. We're ascribing value, but often that value we ascribe to him is based on what he can do for us. This reduction of sacred things explains why we use his name so flippantly and with so little reverence. I mean, take a minute here. Just think about all the presumptions that you've made in your life about God. I know for me, it's part of the reason why this sermon has been so hard for me. I mean, how many of you have read a well-meaning Christian book that tells you this secret to a prayer or a system or a ritual of getting what you want from God, of getting a better job, better finances, fixing your kids, a better relationship? Our definitive words about God we use all the time show that we don't view him as a great mystery anymore. How often do we utter phrases like God always, God never, God only, or even God hates? Such definitive statements about God should be rarely made by fallible humans. But we do this all the time. We've reduced them from this mystery down to this sterile calculation that we know how to control to get what we need in our lives out of him. It's interesting, too, that God usually conforms nicely to our own personal desires. Again, you can go to any Christian bookstore, and on the shelf, you're going to find that God's views on economics, social behaviors, finances, entertainment, pretty much all subjects are crystal clear. As long as you buy the right book, or listen to the right radio station, or tune in to the right preacher. In the New Testament, Jesus had several conversations with Pharisees, the religious teachers at the time. And the religious teachers at the time, they thrived on this theological precision of understanding and knowing and being able to control every aspect of God. One of the most quoted scriptures we know today is John 3:16. It was from a conversation Jesus had with a Pharisee named Nicodemus one night. Nicodemus had this attention to precision that left no room for him to understand what it meant to be born again. All he could think of is this bizarre literal meaning of it. I'm supposed to go back into my mother's womb? How can I? I'm an old man. How can I be born again? And Jesus, in this conversation he had with him, kind of had this other sort of a metaphor wrapped in a pun. He had to try to test Nicodemus' understanding of God. This is from John 3:8. He says that the wind blows wherever it wants. Just as you can hear the wind but can't tell where it comes from or where it is going, so you can't explain how people are born of the Spirit. See, this wasn't the kind of God that the Pharisees and Nicodemus understood. They understood God was like, no. All outcomes of God are programmable, controllable. Pharisees believed that if you were wealthy in your life, that means that these are blessings from God because you had done good things, and if you were sick, ill, or in poverty, this was a clear sign of a sin, often a secret sin that you hid somewhere in your life. They had reduced God to this divine vending machine, and they sought to control God through the system they'd worked out. See, you would make sacrifice A, you would recite this written out prayer B, you would abstain from C, and you get blessing D every single time, outcome guaranteed. They had taken the divine and made him into this controllable, programmable thing. But Jesus says that God wasn't like that. See, the Pharisees' intent to follow God's law wasn't motivated by love for him or reverence for him or worship for him. That's why they figured out exactly how much to tithe to the temple and exactly how long the tassels on their prayer shawls should be. But Jesus says that the God isn't like a divine gumball machine. He's more like the wind. He's uncontrollable, no more containable than wind in a bottle. The wind blows where it wishes, and any attempt to define where it comes from or where it goes is futile. This containment and controlling of God is the consumer Christianity that so many of us subscribe to today. Christian Smith, he's a sociologist from Stanford University, from Notre Dame. After 5 years, he was researching the spiritual lives of teenagers in America. And he came up with this term called moralistic therapeutic deism. Now, you're not going to find the first church of MTD anywhere out there in the streets. No one says that I follow this religion. But this is the religion he found that majority of American teens follow. Moralistic, meaning that God, they believe that God is primarily concerned with you being good, you doing the right thing. Be nice. Therapeutic. The common belief was that God was there to help you work through your problems. God's there to kind of come and help us out whenever we have something that arises in our life. And deism, the fact that God is going to be detached. He comes in when we need him, when we call him to come and help us, but other than that, God is not involved. He just kind of stays out at a distance. Some of the teenagers he interviewed here, we have some quotes for them. This is a 16-year-old guy says that to me, God is pretty much like intervention, like extreme luck. Say you're $50 away from something and you find $50 on the floor, then that's probably God's intervention or something like that. Another gal says that God's all around you all the time. And I'll tell you this too, many of these are from like mainline denominations too. He believes in forgiving people and whatnot, and he's there to guide us for somebody to talk to and help us through our problems. Of course, he doesn't talk back. And Smith said he wasn't sure if she meant that God doesn't ever respond to our prayers or God doesn't speak out of line, but both views are equally telling. Kind of a sarcastic teen from Texas said this one here. Well, God is almighty, I guess, but think he's on vacation right now because of all the crap that's happening in the world, because it wasn't like this back when he was famous. And finally, God is an overall ruler who controls everything. So like, if I'm depressed or something, or things aren't going my way, I blame it on him. I don't know why. Now, any of these statements here sound like anything that you have ever entertained in your heart? Do any of these sound like anything that you have believed about God? Because the reason Christian Smith said he thinks that this view was so prevalent among teenagers is because this is the exact same religion of so many adults. That we hold on to this self-centered view of God. God of moralistic therapeutic deism looks kind of like this. He's one part Toadie Butler, one part fawning genie. He is there to mind his own business and he'll spring into action. It requires nothing about him. It's all about us. You put these two together and this is the God of MTD. Man, aren't you the greatest thing out there? I'm so lucky to be your God. How can I serve you? You're looking nice. I'm so lucky. This God is not Trinitarian. This God did not speak through the prophets of the Old Testament. He didn't speak through the Torah. This God was not resurrected from the dead. This God does not fill people's lives through his Holy Spirit and transform them. This God is not demanding. In fact, he can't be, because his job is to take care of us and our desires and our needs. Consumerism has led most people to view God as a device to be controlled rather than an all-powerful creator to be revered. It would seem that our imaginations of who God is and how we relate to him and why he gave the life of his son for us and why and how he's building his kingdom here on earth has truly been limited to the pleasures of our own bodies made from dust. Because the truth is that many of us carry a brand of Christianity in our hearts, a brand that suits us, a brand that fits well, a brand that is comfortable, but a brand that doesn't cost us too much. I told you there's going to be some big bites we're going through this morning. I hope right now, in some way, you have seen in your heart how consumer Christianity has shaped your view of God, how you've commodified God, how in one way or another, you are a consumer Christian. Through this, I found out I'm a consumer Christian. I mean, what desires have shaped you? What desires are consuming you? What in your life is an empty pursuit, a false god, something you go to again and again, expecting to find satisfaction and fulfillment, only to be left feeling empty? What in your life is dead weight right now, consuming your time, your energy, your finances, and your resources? Now ask yourself, what desires has God given to you? What work did God place you here for? Why did Christ step out of heaven and out of eternity and suffer a shameful death on the cross? Is it so that we could live a comfortable life of complacent faith with a pocket-sized God that we can call upon when we need something? I don't think so. This begins with some refocusing. Refocusing these desires that we all carry. See, Paul, early church founder, wrote all these letters to churches, and one of them that circulated a lot was, we find, is that we know as the books of 1 and 2 Corinthians. In 2 Corinthians, he says to this church who was steeped in a culture quite decadent and quite intrusive on their beliefs of God. It says, so we don't look at the troubles we can see right now, because church, there are so many troubles right now, and so many troubles that I take, that I think are going to end my life, they're going to end this world. Rather, we fix our gaze on things that cannot be seen. For the things we see now will soon be gone, but the things that we cannot see will last forever. Things that we cannot see that are going to last forever. Scriptures tell us that being formed to be like Christ, also known as spiritual maturity, isn't achieved always by getting what we want. It's not a product of seeking immediate gratification. In the earlier part of that same letter in 1 Corinthians 9, Paul, he compares this pursuit of Christ to running in a race of something that's focused. He says that all athletes are disciplined in their training. They do it to win a prize that will fade away, but we do it for an eternal prize. So I run with purpose in every step. Every action we make has a purpose and meaning behind it. It's not just going through the motions. I'm not just shadow boxing. I discipline my body like an athlete, training it to do what it should. These ideas of self-control and discipline and focus are complete odds with consumer Christianity. Surrendering control and embracing self-denial ensures that believers get not what they need, rather ensures that they receive what they need to mature in Christ, not necessarily what they want. It's keeping this eternal perspective. It's moving closer and closer to God with every single step, with every single action, and not settling for the pleasures of this dying, fading world. One of my favorite authors, C.S. Lewis, wrote this brilliant, brilliant passage in a writing he did called The Weight of Glory. He says, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but rather too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling around with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered to us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in the slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at sea, we are far too easily pleased. There's so many desires in this life that are below that which we were created for. The temptation of our consumer-focused world is to settle for these desires. Our imaginations have convinced us that a mud pie is the greatest pleasure we can have, and we just sneer in the face of God the thought that something greater than this is offered to us. We've been programmed to to desire immediate satisfaction rather than the infinite satisfaction that we find in Christ. Self-denial and surrendering of these desires is essential to us growing more and more like Christ. It's complete odds, again, with the values of consumerism and consumer Christianity. But Christ knows that the surrendering of our immediate desires can take hold of an even greater joy. He illustrates this in a really, really short parable. It's in Matthew 13:44. I think it's only like two or three verses. But he tells about a guy who comes across a treasure in a field. I don't know what the treasure is. It's kind of a strange parable when you think about it. I've never found treasure in a field. But obviously, this is an item of great value, and he covers it up. He joyfully sells everything he owns and goes and buys the field. Whatever was in that field was worth far more than all the things that he owned. See, Christ isn't calling us to act foolishly. Rather, he's telling us to do precisely the opposite thing here. Any rational person releases something of small value to gain something of greater value. Jesus is offering us a holiday at sea, but we have to first be willing to abandon those mud pies in the slum. But how do we learn to elevate our desires in a society that's engineered to cultivate false ones inside of us? How do we direct our longings away from things that cannot satisfy us and pleasures that do not last? This transformation happens like all spiritual transformations begin. It starts by following in the footsteps of Jesus Christ. First, this might be the hardest step for some of you, is recognizing God for who he truly is. Jesus spent so much time to go away and be with his Father. Even though he was God, he was constantly going away to pray and be with God. Having an encounter with God that shakes you out of this notion that he is a divine genie that's here to please us. Seeing the reality of him for who he is, ascribing value to him because of his vastness, because of his love, because of his grace, because of his mercy. As a kid, my family would take these incredible vacations like all over the West and up through Canada. I remember sitting on a rock, staring out at the Pacific Ocean, being a jaded, angry teenager away from my family. And I was just staring at these waves rolling in and just seeing the sun going down and just being just overwhelmed by this feeling. I remember we took a trip to New Mexico and Arizona and off to the Southwest. I remember one night at a campsite laying out on a picnic table away from the city, just seeing the stars and seeing that band of the Milky Way and just trying to contemplate the billions and billions of stars of all that was in creation that God had made, things I would never see of planets and moons and all this stuff that was out there. And I remember this sinking feeling of insignificance. But knowing that in that God knew me. See, when our imaginations are jolted into contemplating these things, our response is always the same. If you've ever had one of those moments, the response is always silence. Silence is the beginning of all worship. It's that humility that any rational creature should exhibit when confronted by a power that's so immeasurable that it defies comprehension. Writer of Hebrews described God. He says that we are receiving a kingdom that is unshakable. Let us be thankful and please God by worshiping him with a holy fear and awe. For our God is a consuming fire. With holy fear and awe, recognizing God, you are creator of all things. You speak and worlds come into existence. You breathe and life happens. That we are heir to a kingdom that was established before time, not because of anything that we've done, but because of that's who he is, a consuming fire that made you with a purpose, for a purpose, and on purpose. God does not make junk. And even though I let so many things distract me and so many empty pursuits fill my life and so many things to warp my view of him, he is still good and he is still unchanged. Recognizing God is the first step. The second step, again, another hard one, is knowing that in this life, every one of us has been through pains and trials and sufferings and things that make absolutely no sense. Every single person in this room has a story. Working with students, I get to hear some really heartbreaking stories that our kids go through. But those trials that God allows to come into our life are shaping us to be more and more like our son. Beyond these trials and sufferings, we're called to actually intentionally ingest smaller forms of suffering, the form of spiritual disciplines. See, discipline is something we don't naturally desire to do. Like, I know there's some of you weird people who like to go out and, like, run for fun. I don't get that. I need to go to the gym. That's a hard thing for me to start doing. I keep thinking maybe tomorrow I'll start working out. But desires, like, these things are in direct conflict with our base desires. You know, when I was a kid, I had to discipline myself to start reading. I got home from school, and I'd rather watch Ninja Turtles. But I held off on my immediate animated desires and disciplined myself, and I learned to read, and eventually something that started out as a discipline ceased being a discipline and becomes something that I actually enjoy now. I get joy out of reading. These disciplines come in numerous forms, and this is kind of part of your homework, because, guys, spiritual disciplines teach us to overcome the temptation to gratify our immediate desires so that we can attain a higher one. Some of these disciplines include prayer, meditation, scripture, service, generosity, fasting, even like if you're going on a digital fast. You know, like we have so many screens. I don't know about you guys. Like I spend my day at work staring at a screen. I go home and I stare at another screen. Think about the time you would have to commune with God if you just turned off that screen for a few moments a day. Our lives are filled with so much noise, so many distractions. And these aren't ways of manipulating God, but these are ways where God shapes us to be more and more like his son. But one of the most tangible ways, and one I truly believe is an inverse of consumerism, is living a life that is marked by generosity. A life that is not marked on how much stuff and comfort and pleasure we require, but rather on how much we give of our time and our resources. I implore you to lead a life consumed by generosity. And some of you guys know this. Some of the most generous people I've ever met are the most joy-filled people. The people who give away so much are usually the people who have so much more in their lives. I've experienced it from people I've encountered in my own life, even within this church here. And this is one thing that's been on my mind through all this. Even before this, I was working on this sermon, just as a leader, as a father, as a man in his 30s, I wonder, what is the story that this generation of the church is going to leave? Is it going to be a story of how we carved out an hour a week for God? Will it be a story of how desires have branded our hearts and we've been living these small, inward-focused lives and never finding true satisfaction?
You and I might spend about 70 to 80 years on this earth. Not long when you consider the timeline of eternity. Have you ever wondered what life is all about? Every day we get bombarded with the message to pursue the things of this world. Make money, get stuff, be comfortable, live well. More, 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 and me, me, me. That's the prevailing message of our day. Our generation has a hijacked version of the American dream. But as Christians, we know deep down this distorted view of life isn't real life. We read what the Bible teaches and we see how Jesus lived. Every day we face a choice: to pursue the me, me, me mindset of the American dream, or to pursue Christ. What if this generation was willing to trade in the pursuit of the American dream for a world that desperately needs Christ? To be traders. A trader is a new kind of missionary, not defined by geography. Where you live doesn't make you a missionary. The mission you're on makes you a missionary. Being a trader is a movement that requires us to live out our faith, not just talk about it. As a trader, we must choose daily to sacrifice and be intentional with our time, money, and skills. We can be like the Good Samaritan in the parable. When we're on the road of life and see someone in need, we choose to help. We follow Jesus' instructions to go and do likewise. A trader must hate injustice and find specific ways to bring the hope found in Jesus to desperate situations. It's easy to identify what you hate. What makes your heart break and your fists clench? A trader sees work as worship. Everything you do in life, including your job, can be an opportunity to worship the God who created you. Because God is glorified when we use our God-given passions and skills with excellence. And finally, a trader must act swiftly, because the time is right now. The result of all this would be a generation of traders who are making choices with their time, money, and passions that are kingdom-focused and not self-focused, so that our short time here can have an eternal impact.
Why did God bring you to this city? Why did he give you the job and the resources and the skills and abilities that you had? And I know, yes, some of us are completely different places, but the truth is, we are at an extremely unique point in history right now. We have so much more than like 99% of all humans who've ever walked on the face of this planet has. We're so poised as a culture. We're so rich. We have so many comforts beyond what others have had in the past. We have so much knowledge and technology. And is ours going to be a story how all this blinded us to the divine mantle that God placed on us? Currently, 80% of the world lives in poverty. 20% of the world lives on less than $2.50 a day. Did he believe place us here as a church, as a body of believers of Papillion in 2016 to pursue food, sex, comfort, and pleasure? I mean, I'm not trying to make you feel guilty here, but I want to help you start to pull back the veil, to start to disentangle your reality and see the world as it truly is. 2 weeks ago, we got the opportunity to bring a group of students, junior high students, to Loveland, Colorado on a mission trip. And for some of them, this is their first experience serving in a capacity like this. These students willingly gave up a week of their summer, which is a lot to ask of a junior high student. But not only was that, it was the week of the 4th of July. These kids says, I'm going to give up my holiday with my family, the barbecue and all that stuff, to go and serve others. We did it in a variety of ways. I got to work on a farm the whole week. We had some kids that were working with disabled kids, fixing up elderly homes. Just so many stories came out of that week. But in that week, guys, I know that those kids gained something that they could have never imagined. I experienced something with that group of students I have never, ever, ever experienced in my entire life. I felt this moving of the Holy Spirit within our group. It's hard to put into words. We just had this one night where every single barrier the kids had was let down. In every one of our group, we just talked openly about the hurts we feel in life. And I learned more about my kids in those few moments, things that every one of us, we wept for like an hour for the hurts that we've all been through. Only through an experience like that, that is the Holy Spirit working in the lives of those kids. And it was something that I would have never gained, that they would have never gained, that they would have given up, wouldn't have given up a week of their summer. You know, a lot of people would thank me, thanks for taking the kids on that trip, but you know what, it's my job, I get paid, I get a check. But the real heroes in this are the leaders and the volunteers that went with us. We took Olivia Chavone, Ryan Ellison, and Krista Bidek went with us. And right now there's a group of high schoolers heading down to New Orleans. I also have, Jordy's leading that, but still he's got three other adults who are going with him. People who had to take vacation time off of work, who take their own money, like we try to pay for them, but they're always spending extra money on the kids, taking the Dairy Queen and stuff. But people who are being generous with their times and their giftings and their resources to pour into lives of students is something that I've heard again and again and again from people that work with our kids here at the church, is how much they have gained from it. I've heard again and again how, well, I started this to help out, or I started this, I felt like I needed to serve. I had no idea what God was going to do in my life through this. Giving up something small, they gained something so much more. And the truth is, guys, our church is growing, and we still need people to hold babies on Sunday, and we still need people who say, man, I want to hang out with a fifth and sixth grader. I don't know why, but that's kind of like a weird age, you know? Like, they're kind of little kids. They play with Legos. I guess I do too. But they're getting big, and they need someone who can still have fun with them and show the gospel to them and love them in a unique way. We need people who love junior high kids who are going through all these weird hormone things. And we need people who love high schoolers who are kind of jaded and angry. We need people who want to invest in marriages here in our church. We need people that guys, you know what? If you like to swing a hammer, we have a build team that could use some help doing some work like that. You know, on top of it all too, all ministry costs real money. Our trip to Colorado there, we drove, I think it's been like 1,300 to 1,500 miles. You know, we had to rent vans and pay for gas, and the only reason we could do that is because of the generosity of Reality Church here. The way consumerism shapes the way we view God, generosity also shapes the way we view God in an inverse fashion. A life marked by generosity moves you away from focusing on what we can acquire onto what we can give and what we can do through the resources that God has gifted us with. A life marked in generosity moves you from this inward focus on my life and my comfort to outward. It's seeing the hurt in this world. I think I just said this one about being focused on your comfort. It's giving you a purpose for what we're doing with our time. And most importantly, it leads you from establishing your kingdom here on earth to helping build God's kingdom here on earth. Live a life consumed with generosity. We need to wake up from this false view that we have of a convenient deity, a God that he speaks and matter comes into being. With a word, he calms storms. The breath, he gave life to dust. And in a whisper, he's speaking to your heart right here today in a way that I never could. I look at my daughter, Elsie. She's almost 4 years old, and I marvel at her imagination and hasn't yet fallen asleep. Her prayers are beautiful. Recently, her prayers are, thank you for our food, thank you for making it, thank you for Ferris wheels, and thank you for ladybug rides. The prayers of a child are so revealing because culture's conventionality has not yet hijacked her ability to believe. To her, the world is still full of mystery and possibility, that a word can calm storms, that a fish can feed thousands, and a touch can heal the blind. She's constantly telling me how God made everything. She even recently told me about her grandma's cat who has three legs, how when he gets to heaven, God's going to make him a new leg. And it's going to be black and white, and it's going to match his other legs. A child can readily imagine the kingdom of heaven. That's this alternate reality that so many of us adults struggle to see. We are receiving a kingdom that is unshakable. Let us be thankful and please God by worshiping him with a holy fear and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. What in your life is unshakable? What in your life have you built your kingdom on that is unshakable? Pray with me.